This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. The tragic death of 16-year-old Kyle Plush exposed the failure of the city's 911 center and police response, but it also revealed the month-long bickering inside City Hall over the fate of City Manager Harry Black as a pointless exercise that had to end if anything important was to be addressed. A shift in the stance of Greg Lansman finally brought the curtain down on that melodrama on Saturday morning. But real issues remain. What should be done to strengthen the 911 center? More staff? Better technology? Better training? Better leadership? Turning it over to the county? And what about the police response? Was the failure of the officers sent to the scene due to basic protocols that need to be revised or just bad practice on the spot? To explore these questions, I am joined by three journalists who have been covering developments this week, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Politics, and government reporter Paula Christian.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good.
Good to have you here. And Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wettery.
Hello.
Good to have you back, Chris. And Local 12 politics reporter Anjanette Levy. Anjanette, welcome back.
Thanks.
And if you would like to join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Chris, let's just start not with the specifics, but with the big picture.
Right.
How have things changed at City Hall since last Saturday morning with the departure of Harry Black? He technically resigned, mm-hmm. but he knew the vote was coming later that morning to fire him. Is there a better, more focused working environment, do you think?
I think they would have you believe so. the people that are there, you know, it's interesting because Harry, I think, sat in his sat in his office up to, I think, about 20 minutes before the vote on the first floor of City Hall. And then he emailed his resignation letter in as they were sitting on the floor of council. And there was, of course, a lot of scurrying and oh my goshing and whatnoting until they voted to accept the resignation. I think that made it politically easier for a lot of these council members, because they didn't have to cast that vote, which I think would have enraged some people in town. And so that turned the temperature down on them a little bit put off, I think, some of the reckoning over Harry's, you know, situation to later. I think that they do think they can be more focused on this Kyle Plush 911 center thing. I think that the Black situation, we're going to continue to see things trickle out as we did this week about it over the next months, maybe years even. It's similar to the Chief Blackwell firing from a couple of years ago in that, you know, for example, we didn't even know there was a settlement with the chief until I think months and months, maybe even a year later after it happened. The council has kind of put the kibosh on that by requiring that the city legal department inform them of when they've made significant settlements like that. So I don't think that the legal department will be able to have that fly under the radar should they reach a settlement with the former city manager.
Any observations about the acting city manager? Have any of you had a chance to observe him in practice, or do you know him and interviewed him?
I know something about him that is really interesting. He served in Afghanistan, and guess what his job was? To defuse bombs, to defuse improvised explosive devices.
It could be helpful.
If we had known that, we could have gotten him in much earlier to do that.
Well, you don't know. He may have been doing that all along.
Mm-hmm. He might
trying to help
scenes.
Harry Black out. Who knows?
But I do think that the tone at council
we should
was
also mention his name,
week.
Patrick mm-hmm. Duhaney. I'm
sorry. Patrick Duhaney, yes.
I do think that the tone was different this week at council. I think it was more focused on business and trying to get things done. And it seemed calmer, and it seemed it just seemed like the council members were more willing to stop by and talk. And they seemed, whereas in the weeks prior, they could not walk past the media table fast enough to get away from us. Now they're back to speaking to us, joking around a little bit. It seems like more like business as usual.
Yeah, I think Patrick Duhaney, too, it seems like, too, obviously I don't know if he's going to be a serious contender for the job permanently, but just my impression is, you know, obviously he's been at City Hall for quite some time, but, you know, he seems to be taking a lot of cues from Mayor Cranley. Mm-hmm. And that's just been my observation. You know, he's the other day he kind of deferred to Cranley when people wanted to speak to him at the Emergency Communications Center. I guess that was on Saturday, actually, of last week. So I feel like he's maybe taking a lot of cues from him. And I think maybe that's what Mayor Cranley wants.
I think he probably appreciates that.
I mean, I think that's part of the struggle. I think Mayor Cranley wants to run the city. And I know there were other conflicts between he and Harry Black, but I think he would probably prefer us, you know, to be the guy in charge.
So one thing to keep in mind, I'm sorry, Paul, go ahead.
That's okay. Patrick's also moved up very quickly in the city. I sat down with Patrick probably 2 years ago to do a story on increasing the city's minority contracting awards. And he was in purchasing then, and very sharp guy, very well-spoken, but you know, he was in purchasing, and now he's the acting city manager. That is a huge climb very quickly. So I'm sure, you know, he probably doesn't entirely know how to do this job. He's only been the assistant city manager for 2 months.
Less than a year. So. One thing that's important to consider, in addition to his meteoric rise, he is in his position because of Harry Black. When this resignation occurred, the procedure under the city code is that the city manager designates one of the two assistant city managers to be the acting city manager in case he resigns, dies, whatever. And so while they held this formal vote or whatever, it was meaningless. Harry Black picked his own successor as of right now.
But council could have overridden that, couldn't they?
No.
No?
No. They can
That's
select
in the charter?
It's in the city code. They could select an interim to replace him, which they probably will do at some point. But Harry, you know, they made this whole dog and pony show about, oh, we're going to accept, you know, but no, that's not how the code says.
Let's move on from some of this, the bickering part and the positioning part, to the question of what to do in the aftermath of the Kyle Plush tragedy. And council has taken some actions. Anjanette, yesterday you did a report that used some sound from Dan Hills, the head of the FOP, trying to explain the police perspective on this, because there's been a lot of criticism that they didn't get out of their car, that they weren't aggressive enough, that they were paying attention to other things. What did he have to say, and what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, he's claiming that their response was completely reasonable and consistent, and then these are his words, reasonable and consistent with the information that they had at the time. He doesn't appear to think that it's a big deal that they didn't get out of the vehicle to look inside vans, whether or not they even saw a van from the cruiser. He just claims they didn't have enough information, and I almost feel like, or kind of wonder, whether or not he in some ways is trying to soften the blow, because he seems to be saying, look, this is on the dispatch center. You know, our guys would have, he kept saying they would have broken every window in the place. But, you know, what were their actions enough? I mean, did they go far enough to try to locate that van? He told me that they drove through two parking lots near that thrift store, because the original dispatch said that the vehicle was possibly in the thrift store parking lot, but they didn't physically drive into that lot where Kyle Plush's van was. They drove past it on Red Bank Road. So he said there was a lot of commotion at that time because school was getting out, and they figured there would be more activity if there was an emergency. So I think there are still a lot of questions. I mean, we weren't—
Well, actually, you know, we have a caller. Dave is on the line, and he has some questions or an observation about this. Dave, what would you like to ask?
Hello, everybody. How's everybody doing?
Good.
Good.
Yeah, listen, my only comment is this here. I'm not saying that the 911 center needs to be improved. It may need to be. I think the reason why this young man died was because the police officers did not get out of their car and actually look inside the vehicles. That's very important, because you can have a heart attack and call in, and if you're having a heart attack and you fall over in your seat, well, just to drive by and look, you're not going to see that person. And as far as Dan Hills is concerned, people have to realize one thing. Dan Hills is like a union representative. He represents the Cincinnati Police Department, and his job is to defend them. So when you look at him and what his job is, he may say a lot of things that may not be 100% accurate or correct, because his job is to make you look good even though you look bad, or to make you right when you're wrong. That's what his job is. But I still say that the police, when they got out of their car and looked into the vehicles, they would have found this young man, and he would still be alive today.
Well, let me pursue that a little bit. I mean, one of the real issues there is they didn't have good – and I agree with you about Dan Hills, by the way. That is his job.
He is the president of the union.
He's the president of the FOP.
Yeah. And
it is his
point.
Job to
yeah.
defend. So I'm not trying to present him as an objective reporter. But the question is, they weren't even in the right parking lots. Mm-mm. And they weren't even looking towards the right parking lots. They were looking at wrong parking lots.
Well, there's no question if they had better information.
So the question goes back. City Council has already put a lot of money pretty quickly into taking some steps with the 911 center. What have they done, and what does that money indicate they think the issues are there?
Well, I think they're trying to do something quickly to show that they are doing something to try and solve the problem. This week they approved it's amounts to roughly $1.4 million over two fiscal years, an immediate infusion of $454,000 into the 911 center, and that's to hire a few more people this year and to invest in some new technology, not major technology investment, but things like new computer monitors. And then, you know, probably what's getting the most attention is, you know, a fresh paint color and some new chairs at the 911 center.
You know, to me, this fire and fury over this. I mean, we don't even know root cause of this, right? We are. I feel like without the report, the final report, or I guess there's
now,
several
are
investigations.
I was going to say, how many reports are out there?
I would go for like getting at least one of them before I would.
Well, the police report, I thought, was supposed to be due next Monday, but it probably will not be.
Well, Christopher Smitherman, he's the chair of Law and Public Safety, tweeted out just in the last couple of hours that he's calling a special session of the Law and Public Safety Committee on May 2nd, because that is when
Which would be Wednesday.
Correct, at 9 a.m., and that's when the police investigation into this is expected to be complete. So it was supposed to be ready on Monday, but Monday is going to be the 911 action plan. But I think Chris makes a very valid point. We don't know. Mm-hmm. We don't know. I mean, it may come out that there was this massive technical failure. It may come out that there was a failure on many levels. You know, we just don't know.
So we know there are systematic problems with the 911 center. But what we don't know is that they had any relation to why this poor kid ended up dying. We don't know that the two are connected or not. We have no idea. And, you know, the thing about the police union president's accounting of what his officers told him, you know, it just underscores to me what a freak accident this was. From the seat rolling onto the kid to the lack of, you know, to the second 911 call, the information not being relayed, everything that went wrong did go wrong.
But from City Council's perspective, it's almost irrelevant how that police report comes out as to what happened that day. They had to do something last week, and they have to continue to do something to improve the 911 center for optics alone. I mean, it's not just this poor child's death. There's a long documented history of problems with the 911 center that have not changed year after year after year.
This tragedy made all of those reports that they have received over the years very clear.
Yes.
Right.
But it's not like the information about the – particularly the lack of being able to maintain a steady employee base, being able to maintain and update technology, those sorts of things they've been receiving reports on for quite a while.
So regardless of where the blame lies in that report, there is some blame for City Council. And that's what they're trying to take responsibility for in making these improvements, is their share of the blame here.
And all of them knew, and the city manager ended up the scapegoat. He's the only one who got fired.
Well, it didn't. I don't know
you
if
can't
you
fire
all,
elected officials.
Right, right. But
I don't know if you all felt like this, but I kind of felt like this was almost a way holding that hearing, the 5-hour hearing that we attended about the 911 center. It was the nail in Harry Black's coffin. I mean, it was almost a way to really push him out. I know that they wanted to deal with the problem, but it seemed like, you know, the day before that somebody had made the comment that the buck stops with Harry Black. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's
kind of a
direct quote. And I feel like that was kind of like it was almost like a twofer.
It was a show trial. It was anybody who's got an opinion, come on up and right. give it. You know, I mean, it was the trial that the mayor wanted to have but couldn't actually have. And, he ended up having it.
With the money that's been appropriated, and it's over 2 fiscal years.
Yes.
I think, Paula, you were the one who was pointing that out. Where did it come from? I mean, we're in the budget process.
There's always money. Don't you know that? It's a shell game.
It was some fun.
It was buildings and inspections. So it came from there.
Was it a special fund or was it regular operating money?
It was a couple different funds in that department. But it doesn't really matter where it came from because you can move money wherever you – I mean, the city can always come up with money for what it needs. But, you know, the city's in a tough financial spot right now.
Well, that's right. They're in budgeting right now too.
They are going to have a real problem. And, you know, another point, I forget who made it at city council, but there are pretty much every department in the city could claim they are understaffed and their equipment is bad and they're lacking technology and their working conditions aren't good and they need a new building.
None of that sounds like private industry, though.
No, not at all.
It happens at every institution. We don't have enough people and we don't have good enough technology. I mean, it is expensive to stay on top of these sorts of things.
Absolutely. But the way that we have budgeted in the city is fire, police, and somewhat of public services, they are held harmless in every budget and every other department gets the cuts. This may be the year that they can't actually do that. Mm-hmm. We're waiting for details on this. I actually asked for the latest deficit number more than a week ago, and mysteriously it has not shown up yet from a public records request. I know they have it, but they haven't released it. So I think it's going to be pretty bad.
It's coming. It's coming at 4:30 today.
Oh yeah,
that's when
Friday,
they release
it,
all of their public records requests. It's nothing happens before 4 on a Friday. You should know that.
As if I can't look at it on Monday.
That was like the body camera video last Friday.
Everything.
It was 3:30 on a Friday. We got the Osborne in Brazil body camera footage. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we have a caller, Sandy, who has called in and also has a question on this whole center question. Sandy, what's your question?
My question is, does not the 911 center call have a GPS in order to pinpoint these calls when they're coming in? I mean, Kyle is calling on a cell phone, so I just want to know, is there no locator part of the 911 that you can locate, pinpoint exactly where these calls are coming from?
Excellent question.
They did a phase 2 is what it was called on the CAD. And if you read the original CAD, the first dispatch, it says that a woman called and said that she was either shut or trapped in her van and couldn't hear the operator, and that they did what's called a phase 2 location. And they were able to say that they believed, or at least the call taker had said she believed, that the car was possibly in the thrift store parking lot.
And how far away was the thrift store parking lot from the parking lot where Kyle Plush's van actually was?
Well, there were I'm going to try to describe it.
Okay.
I can show you on a map. But there's the thrift store. There's a lot behind the thrift store, which I was told they drove through. There's a front lot to the thrift store. And Kyle's vehicle was in the lot adjacent to that front parking lot of the thrift store. So it's more of a student lot, but it was in that general vicinity of the thrift store.
Visible? Visual? Do you have visual contact from one of the thrift store lots to the other lot?
The front one, you would think you'd be able to see it, but I mean, I wasn't there at that time of day. I don't know. I've only been there when there weren't any other vehicles in the lot.
I want to sort of pick up on the implications here. Where do we stand when Manager Black resigned? He made it clear he was not giving up his legal rights to sue. He had also made some very serious charges against Mayor Cranley about interfering with economic development. Where do those sorts of legal questions stand?
You know, I think that what he was trying to tell you or try to tell us is, you know, he was reserving the right to sue. And, you know, I expect him to sue. And
you do expect him to sue?
I do. I absolutely do.
And I don't know if I do. I think he's probably weighing what that will look like.
For securing a future job?
Yeah. I mean, because if he sues, it all comes out. Every allegation on both sides comes out. And Harry's a pretty young guy. And I mean, any employer that wants to hire him from across the country could read. I mean, we'll, if he sues, we'll cover it. I mean, and every allegation, every on both sides, and it will be nasty, will come out, and then it's broadcast all over the media. And then so he wants to go work for a private corporation. Well, are they going to want to tie themselves to that?
It's too late, though. The you know, all of the stuff that already came out, you can Google that. I think that, you know, I think that he.
What about the charge about the mayor interfering with economic development in ways that, I mean, the way the charge is leveled, it is favoritism.
It's
pay to play. Where does that stand? Anybody picking up on that?
You know, it's a very serious charge, and you know, it's unclear where that's going, and whether there's, you know, he wrote these things called memos to file, right?
Right.
It's very similar to what James Comey did. And so I think the question that we don't have answered is, are there more of those memos? And if so, where are they? And where do they go? You know, I don't know. I don't know the answer. I don't know where it goes or whether it goes
anywhere. If I were Harry, I would have had a lot more ammunition. I would have documented a lot more. I would have been
before you made the charge.
Yes. When you shoot the king, you have to shoot to kill. And I don't know if – I mean, that's just – I don't know if what he had there was – I was expecting – a dossier of some very serious allegations. And I was underwhelmed by what he presented.
But is there more? I don't know.
Was it designed to entice someone?
Mm-hmm. Well, Paula, you have been reporting about what may be the next brouhaha at City Hall, and that is this proposal for an entertainment center on the banks.
Yes.
And it seems like even though no formal proposal has been passed on from the Joint Banks Committee to the city, the mayor is already saying he has ideas about what ought and ought not to be there. Where does all this stand?
Well, my colleague Amanda Seitz and I have been trying to figure out what's going on at the banks for going on 2 years with this concert venue. It's been very difficult to get information because the Joint Bank Steering Committee does not hold public meetings. I think they've held one public meeting in
they're not a public institution as such.
Well, that's open to interpretation. They are appointed. This is a group of very influential, powerful business people in Cincinnati that have been appointed by the city and the county to come up with recommendations on the banks. So, and let's not forget that the public owns the land of the banks. It is public property.
We have a lot invested there.
Yes.
With all of the infrastructure.
It's $135 million public.
Right.
Property investment.
How quickly do you think this is going to come?
Oh, I think next
become
week.
Become public.
I mean, they met this week. They had a meeting this week that was not open to the open to the public, where they discussed who they would like to give this concert venue bid to. And I think they're going to make a decision next week. Mayor Cranley weighed in that he would like it to be an indoor and outdoor facility. No public funds being spent on it, and the same concerns that the banks chief investor had.
Gee, are you setting up next week's show? No, anyway.
They got to have county and city approval for it, right?
Both
of
them?
Mm-hmm. So whatever the joint steering committee, as many grand poobahs are on there as there are, you know, they may not actually – they're not necessarily making the final decision. And I noticed that Councilman Seelbach, of all people, said
he
was
shocked?
was in agreement with the mayor on this.
I was
the mayor makes
shocked.
A lot of sense on this issue, I think. I don't know why you would build an indoor concert venue on the banks. That seems crazy.
We will save that. I just wanted to set that up, knowing that that's bubbling. But I want to thank Paula Christian from WCPO.com, Chris Wetterich from Cincinnati Business Courier, and Ann Jeanette Levy from Local 12 News. After the break, a review of local news developments, including two federal lawsuits and an imminent reopening of the Children's Museum. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. This past week, Cincinnati was the focus for a number of stories with national implications. Joining us now to discuss them and other local stories are WVXU reporters Tana Weingartner and Bill Reinhardt. Tana, Bill, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Lots of things happening.
Yeah.
Let's start with the family, Cynthia and Fred Warmbier, the parents of Otto Warmbier, who died after whatever happened to him in a North Korean prison, have filed a lawsuit against North Korea.
Right.
What do they expect? Why are they doing this, do you think?
Well, I think they're doing it to make a point. Now, there's also the possibility, and because they can under the U.S. law that's sort of in place for this to set up. But I think to make a point, and there is the possibility. So in 1965 or something, the USS it just went right out of my head. The crew members of this ship were taken in and
yes.
held captive, correct?
In
Pueblo. Thank you. And they were tortured. And so their families and the crew members sued and they won. It was like a $65 million judgment. Of course, they saw none of that money from North Korea. However,
the U.S. government ultimately
exactly
paid them.
So there is the possibility of a payout for that's the biggest question I've heard a lot of people saying, like, they're not going to get any money. There is the possibility of the payout. And then just today I was speaking with Senator Rob Portman, and he says that money would go to a nonprofit to help people that have been tortured by this and to fight for the people that are still there. We still have three Americans in detention in North Korea.
Well, I think it seems to me that there's a certain timeliness to a lawsuit like this because the President Trump is going to, looks like, have a summit meeting with Kim Jong-un. Mm-hmm. And this is a reminder from the Warmbiers, do not forget our son and do not forget these other prisoners, American prisoners in North Korean prisons. It may be more about that than it is about money.
I would think so.
This will complicate things for the president as he's taken a very strong stance against North Korea over the Warmbier case, over their nuclear program. And now he wants to go make nice with them as North Korea and South Korea are trying to unify. So this is
I don't know that they're trying to unify.
Not unify, making peace.
At least make peace.
Making ups, excuse me, yes. But as all of that is happening, you've got that delicate diplomatic tightrope, and this is throwing another plate to have to juggle as you're walking that tightrope.
Senator Rob Portman did say he supports the suit, however, so.
The Warmbiers?
Yes.
Yes. Well, I'm sure that that be the case. Another issue, another set of actually, there was a legal case involved at one point, and that is the announcement of Richard Spencer, the white nationalist, announcing that he is not coming to the University of Cincinnati to speak. Now, he was the uninvited speaker,
right,
as everybody from UC would tell you anytime you talk to them about this. But also, he had a legal suit against the university, and both of those things have been withdrawn. He's not coming, and he's not going to sue. What do you think happened here?
I think there was a lot of behind-the-scenes negotiations via email. You know, Bill, you said before you think he was just basically trying to get his name in the news, and it worked.
It could be. There's also financial implications. You got to look at Fred Phelps and his church, Westboro Baptist in Kansas. They're often accused of, you know, doing provocative things and then getting banned or blocked or shut down and then suing. And it's often said that that's how they make their money. That's how they make their living, is through lawsuits. And one could say Richard Spencer's been trying to do the same and perhaps not with as much success.
Well, yeah, he didn't succeed here because according to the court documents, they're both paying their own attorney's fees and court fees. So he's not making any money off UC.
And it strikes me that it may be important here that the cultural mood has shifted and that he no longer thinks he has a chance in front of a jury to get this lawsuit through. So it's not going to be as easy as it might have looked like 10 months ago after Charlottesville.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Okay. I'll throw that out. Okay. Third case. The Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, Federal Court of Appeals, that sits here in Cincinnati, is taking under advisement a case that involves hundreds of Detroit area Iraqi refugees who are here. Who are these people? They're fighting to stay here, not be deported back to Iraq. What are the issues here that are at stake?
Well, they're largely, and forgive me, I'm going to mispronounce it, Chaldean Christians, but not all. Some of them belong to other Muslim sects that are oppressed in Iraq. So these are people who've been living in the States and then did something wrong. They ended up getting a conviction, a criminal conviction on their record of some kind. So they've had deportation orders against them for a long time. However, U.S. immigration officials have continued to allow them to live here because of the argument that if they were deported, they would face torture, persecution, or death. However, under the new administration, they rounded a bunch of them up and were going to just deport them and were holding them anyway. Then in January, I believe, one of the judges in the case ruled that they should be released. So the federal government is also objecting to that. They're saying that's overstepping the bounds. They didn't follow the procedure.
That was a district court judge, right?
Correct. And so the federal government is arguing that they didn't follow the steps that you should go through in the process.
What is the status of these individuals right now? Are they still in detention or have they been released?
My understanding is they've been released. They were ordered released in January. And so it's, you know, the case is the one out of Detroit, which is around, maybe around 200 or so, but it affects about 1,400 Iraqis nationwide. Okay. So, and there, we don't know when the Sixth Circuit might rule.
Yes, they take things under advisement. And was this heard by three judges or en banc?
No, the three-judge panel.
Three-judge panel. Yep. So they'll have to decide what they're going to do next.
Correct.
So a lot of other things were happening locally. those were sort of local developments that had national and international implications.
Right.
But there are some other things that aren't so serious. We have a penguin at the aquarium.
Animals.
Yeah. Always have an animal story.
It's my favorite part of the day, right, Phil?
So what's the situation with, do we have a paralyzed penguin?
A poor paralyzed penguin, Victoria. It turned out they found her laying in her enclosure at the Newport Aquarium and they couldn't figure out what was wrong and they did.
So this is a long time resident.
Yeah, this was going
on. I just went to a penguin encounter in January. Oh. I wonder if I met Victoria.
She has red bands on her wings.
Oh,
that's how you can tell her.
Very dignified.
So it turned out they actually did a CT scan of all things on a penguin. If you want to see what that looks like, WVXU.org, we have a picture. But they found a hole or a lesion on her spinal cord that was affecting her. So they've been doing rehab. She's been going to rehab and she's regained use of one of her foot and feet, and she's working on the other one. So they say she kind of swims in circles in her enclosure. She seems to be happy. And penguins molt. When they molt, they lose all their feathers, so she went through molting last month, they said. And they had to make her an ice bath because they get very hot. They can overheat. So there's a very cute picture of her sitting in a big pile of ice.
Well, if you've never gone to – I took my 5-year-old granddaughter to the penguin encounter at the aquarium. It was part of the Christmas present. Mm. So penguins, I mean, you gotta love penguins.
They're pretty cute.
Yeah. So
I was at the zoo the other day and their penguin was also swimming like a mad penguin and it was pretty cute.
Cooling down. Okay. So we also have a new manatee at the zoo. Is that right, Bill?
Her name is Daphne. She's 1 year old, about 250 pounds. Her favorite foods are lettuce and
and more lettuce.
Lots of lettuce. Florida this
week. Have you ever been there when they're feeding them?
I have not.
Oh my gosh, it's amazing. You have a diver who goes in with this board that's filled with heads of lettuce, and you just reach it out. It's amazing. That'd be a great job in retirement.
Well, Daphne does not have a mother. She came to the Cincinnati Zoo this week because her mother, she was found earlier this month in Florida. Her mother had been hit by a boat and did not survive. So Daphne came to the Cincinnati Zoo, one of only two zoos outside of Florida that helps rehab manatees. Two other manatees went to the Columbus Zoo. Last I heard, they had not been named yet. And now we have four manatees at the Cincinnati Zoo, three males and Daphne. A lot of people have been asking, are they going to mate? Are they going to breed more manatees? And the answer is no, because all of these manatees are going to be released back into the wild, and you don't want to release a baby manatee that's never lived in the wild because they just won't know what to do with themselves.
Okay. And they're – even a one-year-old sounds pretty big.
Yeah. She's not small.
And one other thing. The Children's Museum at Union Terminal is about to reopen. It had to be closed.
Oh, well, let's stick with the animals because we've got the butterfly story.
Yeah,
let's stick with the animals.
I miss the butterfly story. Tell me about the butterflies.
Okay, last Friday, Cincinnati police said they were looking for a woman who had stolen a butterfly from the Crone Conservatory. It was a blue Morpho African butterfly, very collectible, very rare in this part of the world.
Well,
you're only going to find them at the Crone Conservatory or in someone's private collection.
Or at a zoo.
But yeah, April 15th, a woman walked out of the Crone Conservatory with this butterfly, and police released surveillance video. And today, last night, I just tweeted this. What happened? Do they identify a suspect? Well, today they have identified a suspect. 36-year-old Jamie Revis of Springfield Township. We've got a photo of her, and police would like to hear from you if you know where she is. She does have a number of charges in her history, most of which were dismissed. She did plead guilty to making an offensive gesture once.
Okay.
Breaking news.
Yes, breaking news.
Well, so the question really is the butterfly. The butterfly was it was not a chrysalis. It was an actual butterfly.
It was an actual butterfly, yeah.
So, you know.
What happened to it, we don't know.
They just kind of collected it. It probably was sold.
Sold, yeah. Well, last quick question.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Children's Museum about to reopen.
Yes.
And this is a chance for people to get a look inside Union Terminal after all this construction.
Yeah.
Part of it.
Yeah. Children's Museum closed last November. It was originally going to stay open during the entire overhaul of Union Terminal, but they said, we need to close it down because we've got to do some work on top of it. But this next Friday.
Long-term leaks.
Yes. Children's Museum will be reopening up next Friday. We got a sneak peek inside of the area, and there's been a lot of changes. You know, used to be you'd go down that first escalator, there'd be a big orange wall, you'd go down a second escalator. Well, that big orange wall is gone. Mm-hmm. And right now you can't go in to see what the other parts of the museum look like yet because they're still under construction. They're expecting the entire project to be done by this November. Mm-hmm. Don't have an exact date on when the museum will be reopened.
But when you go down that escalator thing, that's going to be the new entrance to the museum. Before, when you went into the rotunda, you either went left or right to go into
history or science.
Right. Now you're going to go down to that mezzanine, and that's the entrance. And then you won't have to kind of go between the two areas. They're going to be coinciding.
Having just ended my third tour of duty with this time the Freedom Center, but it's part of the Museum Center. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, we know a lot about that. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Catching up
on a huge range of topics, some more important than others. So
some of the news that's fit to talk about.
So thank you, Tana and Bill. After a short break, a new museum in Alabama that forces visitors to confront one of the darkest tragedies in American history, lynching. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. In 1997, I happened into an exhibit in New York City entitled Without Sanctuary, a photo history of lynching in America. It is the most powerful history exhibit I have ever encountered. Since then, many museums have shown a spotlight on the implications of lynching, especially the new Mississippi Civil Rights Museum, which I had a chance to visit last month in Jackson, Mississippi, and the National African American Museum, where I happened to be this past Monday. But the new National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama, commemorates 4,400 Americans who were lynched between 1877 and the end of Reconstruction and 1950. I am joined now by Cincinnati Enquirer Mark Kernute, who wrote a powerful article not only about the new museum, but localizing it into cases that come from our region. If you would like to join our conversation, you may call 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Mark, thanks for being here today.
You're welcome.
This is a difficult topic. What's the purpose of this exhibit?
You know, I think you take it from, you know, straight from the director of the Equal Justice Initiative, which organized and created the memorial and a museum, Brian Stevenson, that we aren't going to be able to deal effectively with our race issues today, which by many accounts are worsening, if we don't take an honest look at the truth of our history. And it's not that – it's not ancient history. We're not an old country. You know, this occurred this memorial documents these 4,400 African-American lives that were lost to white mobs from 1877, which you said was the end of Reconstruction, through 1950. So it's not that long ago that this was happening in our country.
And one of the things that really I think we need to come to grips with – is how the country up to this point has or has not responded to lynching in the United States.
Exactly. And Dan, and probably in, you know, I know you had your recent stint as interim director at the Freedom Center. And I know in the earlier this decade, it hosted a
Without
Sanctuary and had the lynching photographs. And even its existence, memorializing the Underground Railroad, and I'll make my point here quickly, that has drawn ire from people who, and I would suggest, I haven't been to Montgomery yet, but I've been in the Freedom Center dozens and dozens of times. From the looks of the memorial and the museum in Montgomery, it's more difficult to digest and encounter than the Freedom Center. And this is not selling the Freedom Center short.
No.
And I look at the opposition and anger that the Freedom Center has encountered since it was created, even before it opened its building in 2004. So we have not, as a country, acknowledged this. And I think the other point that's really critical that the Equal Justice Initiative is making, because in addition to the memorial, it has a museum that draws a line directly from slavery through Reconstruction, through Jim Crow, through the Civil Rights Movement, to voting rights, through all these things that are still happening, the second-class citizenship of African Americans.
Mass incarceration,
police community relations, the Black Lives Matter movement, all of these things are a continuum that they are drawing this line from, from the time the first Africans were brought to these shores.
You know, one of the things I always like to point out is that the United States never adopted an anti-lynching law, even though the NAACP, which one of the sparks for creating the NAACP in the first decade of the 20th century was a response to the lynching situation, and they would literally hang out the window of their offices a banner the day after there was a new lynching. And there was pressure for decades to pass anti-lynching laws. Never got done. We have always denied this sort of reality in American life.
And the other thing, Dan, and those pictures are powerful. A man was lynched yesterday. It was the banner that, I forget the street in New York, but it hung high over the street in New York at the NAACP office. But the other piece in the research that has been done in much of the scholarship by this group in Montgomery is that you can see the transition from lynching, which fell out of favor, especially public lynching, to capital punishment, which again has been historically inequitably applied to people of color and poor people.
Yeah, let's be clear about lynching. Lynching was a public act by and large. It was meant to be done in the public square. It was one of the whole purposes was to sow fear into the African American community. And we are not just talking about hanging people. We're talking about mutilating the bodies, mistreating in every possible way. And one of the stories you tell is about someone in Oxford. In our area, you try to localize this story. This isn't just a Southern story. And Henry Corbin, when he was lynched, he was hung, but it wasn't just that.
He was, according to newspaper accounts of the day, he was shot at 400 times with pistol balls. And that tree, when it was cut down some 20 years later, broke the blade in the sawmill because the trunk of the tree was so filled with metal, it couldn't be cut. And we have additional stories that are going to run, Dan. The one that posted online yesterday is going to be in our Sunday print paper. And then we have additional stories coming Monday and Tuesday. And I think the focus of our, as you just said, of our research and our reporting is to show that it happened here and that we have struggled as a region. And you can't just point to Alabama or Mississippi and Texas and say it happened there. We have documented 8 cases of lynching of African Americans in Boone County, 2 in Butler County, and 1 in Claremont County.
So this is our story, not just the South story, is the point that you're trying to make.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, with the help of some talented research librarians, both in Boone County and up in Oxford, as well as we were able to get a hold to find a descendant of Henry Corbin. And she spent the day with us, myself and my colleague, Sam Green, a visual journalist. And we documented her retracing or attempting to retrace her ancestor's final steps before his lynching in Oxford. And that is the Monday story.
One of the really sobering aspects of the Without Sanctuary exhibit was the key elements were postcards. And they would have photographs of a lynching. And you could look at the back of the photograph and the casual comments, dear Aunt Matilda, so-and-so was lynched yesterday. By the way, how is your garden growing this summer? It is just shocking the mental framework that existed there.
Exactly. And then you also see in those postcards, when you see pictures, you see children and women at these lynchings because they were public spectacles.
Yeah. So Mark Kernute has an article coming Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. So thank you very much for this coverage. Very important. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.